I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about hate crimes and hate crime laws. The Indiana General Assembly has before it a measure that would establish the first state hate crimes law in Hoosierland. We will talk about what hate crimes are and what the measure might do to combat them. My guests are Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, the Jewish Community Relations Council in Indianapolis. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here in Indiana. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Well, my guests are two returnees to the show, veterans of these sorts of discussions. We're welcoming back Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, who is the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council here in Indianapolis. It's good to have you both here. Well, we probably ought to start, I always like to start a little bit basic here. We ought to talk about what, before we get into what the bill, the measure would do, what a hate crime is, how we are defining that. David, I'll start with you on that one.
A hate crime is a crime where the victim or victims are intentionally selected because of a perceived bias. So somebody that is intentionally selected for something like their race, color, national origin, something like that, where the perpetrator of that crime not only wants to target that individual, but send a message to the entire associated community of intolerance and hatred.
Okay. And Prosecutor Curry, then I'm going to ask the tough, how do you establish that? How do you establish that it's an assault is a hate crime rather than, a simple assault?
Well,
not that any assault is simple.
Well, I think we'll probably get into that further in terms of how it would be established under this law, in that it is not a separate crime as such, but it would be an aggravator for purposes of sentencing. Mm-hmm. But as a general proposition, under Indiana law and virtually any state's law, when you have charged a crime, you're only required to prove the elements of that crime. Mm-hmm. It is not necessary to prove a motive mm-hmm. for that crime. But as a practical matter, in many situations, we will want to prove that. In other words, in order to sort of underpin the proof of the elements, that there was a specific motive involved. And so, and I think we'll probably get into this as we talk about how the Indiana law has been written and mm-hmm. and how we hope to have it passed, that it could arise in the context of proving the case in chief in the trial itself. It could be evidence that be presented as sentencing completely separate from the trial itself. And so, again, there's no single answer to your question.
Okay. How large a problem is this, David?
Well, certainly it's a problem not only in Indiana, but across the country. Here in Indiana, there were 75 hate crimes reported last year to the FBI. And across the country, there was something close to about 6,000 hate crimes reported across the country. And we actually think that those numbers are actually underreported for a number of reasons, including that crimes of this nature often target communities or individuals that don't necessarily have a good relationship with law enforcement, have language challenges and things like that. So certainly a problem, and actually probably an underreported problem.
And you say there were 75 here in the state last year. What were they like? What was? Can you give me some specific examples of what happened?
Sure, excellent. So specific numbers, crimes targeting race, there were 25 of those last year. Religion, there were 9 specifically, and 6 targeted at for sexual orientation. So that's really the top 3. I think a great example is one that is still going through the legal process right now. So I think it's yet to be determined whether it's officially a hate crime, but I think on the surface we would certainly look at it as a hate crime, and that's what took place in Bloomington just a couple of months ago. There was a 19-year-old sophomore who was walking through town, noticed a Muslim woman sitting with her child in a cafe there in Bloomington, walked into the cafe, started chanting white power and other anti-Muslim epithets, and then proceeded to rip her headscarf off and begin choking her. And only when other patrons came to her rescue and pulled that individual off, was she able to walk away from that incident. This is the type of case that we would classify as a hate crime. We would, think that this statute would help protect somebody where there was an intentional, sort of pre-motivated targeting of an individual.
Would this sort of legislation, Prosecutor Curry, make your job easier or harder? Because at some level, it sounds like you are adding another layer there that has to be proven. I mean, if there are witnesses and all of that caught this guy choking, the assault case is relatively easy to make, I think. It's the motivating piece that we talk about that might be a little more difficult.
Right. I mean, it would add some additional element, but I don't think any significant, to get back to your original question, in these instances, if we had, for example, the Monroe County instance, we would want to prove as part of our case the entirety of what transpired and the motivation for doing it. We have, as we testified the other day, and it's the same as the Monroe County case, it's a pending case, so I can't go mm-hmm. into too much specifics on it, but certainly set forth in the probable cause charging information that the intimidation that occurred was as a result of the victim being gay. Mm-hmm. A number of acts that occurred. So I don't think it's not a overly burdensome additional element for us in these cases. And more to the point, if crime is motivated by bias, then we absolutely feel that individual is more culpable, and we want that person to be dealt with accordingly.
If you had how many of these incidents? We said 75 in the state. And this is going to be coming back your way eventually, David, on this to get an overview. But how many of these incidents do you see, in the course of a year here in Indianapolis and Marion County?
Well, certainly we see them on a regular basis in terms of how many of the 75 out of Marion County. I do not know. But I also agree completely with David that those sorts of instances are underreported, and that even if there is a crime that is reported that the victim is embarrassed or otherwise intimidated into not sharing that part of the story with the investigators.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation today on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So we've gotten breakdowns that, some of these are race-based, some of these are faith-based, some of these are on the basis of sexual orientation and all of that. Are there other breakdowns? Is this more an urban problem or a rural problem? Are there certain parts of the country or the state where we have greater numbers or incidents, or does the data break down?
I think it's probably a little bit more of an urban problem than anything. But, I think when you look at the data, the numbers might be a little bit higher in an urban setting, but it really is an across-the-board issue. What was the other question? I'm sorry.
Well, I was asking if the urban, rural, if there are any other breakdowns that we can get out of that that tell us the nature of where it's likely to occur?
A lot of states have higher reported incidents, particularly on the East Coast. But I really do think that a lot of that comes back to that they have better reporting standards than we do. And their law enforcement agencies in cities and towns are more accustomed to doing reporting. And folks there, you know, again, going back to this issue of underreporting, they're better about reporting these incidents. And so I think a lot of those states where you see large jumps in numbers, it really comes down to a bit more about the reporting standards than it does about number of crimes. I think when you look at most states across the country, proportionally, they're fairly uniform.
How many other states do have hate crime laws?
So 45 other states in the District of Columbia have hate crime statutes, so we're hoping to make Indiana number 46.
Okay. And the federal government.
And the federal government. Right. And what are the states besides Indiana that don't have?
So it is Wyoming, South Carolina, Georgia, and Arkansas. And Wyoming, I think, is really unfortunate because the hate crime statute is actually named after Matthew Shepard,
who lived and was killed
in Wyoming. So.
So we are part of, by my math, the 10% then that doesn't have this sort of legislation. What's prevented it? I'm going to ask you, throw this out to both of you. What's prevented us from considering this before? Or have we considered it and it not gone anywhere?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to some misperceptions about the legislation that I think we will probably get into this afternoon about how you view crimes. I think certainly some of it comes down to, civil rights and which characteristics, which classes are protected in the legislation has certainly been an issue.
Yeah, that's a rather supercharged discussion in this state.
Yeah,
right
absolutely.
Now,
we're trying to stay a little bit under the radar on, but I think those are probably the two biggest issues: are misconceptions and then the protected classes.
Yeah, and I think I would add to that some of the counter argument is why should there be someone who is protected in a way that other victims would not be, and clearly we already recognize that in the criminal law. You know, if a victim is a child, that's treated mm-hmm. differently than if that same crime is against an adult. If the victim is a senior citizen, mm-hmm. there are many instances where that is treated differently, and so that's been part of the education process is to address that. This is not a novel concept in the context of our criminal code.
Well, and probably in the interest of full disclosure, should say during my time as the executive director of the ACLU of Indiana, hate crimes was kind of a problematic issue, in part because there were concerns about the whole idea of thought policing and saying, and you know, one of the arguments at least I would hear during those days is if you say, you know, it's wrong to beat someone up because of his or her race, faith, or sexual orientation, aren't you saying it's slightly more acceptable than to beat them up just because you want their money?
Actually, what we're trying to stress to people is that there's an extra element to these crimes, and that's really what we're trying to address. You know, certainly the physical act of the crime really is no different and should probably be prosecuted the same way. But what we are talking about is that extra element of these crimes, the element that is sending a message not only to the individual or individuals that were targeted, but to the entire groups that are associated. You know, again, that message of intolerance and hatred, and that you really are, you know, we are prosecuting, we are punishing action, not thought here. We're addressing the extra element, and we're addressing the element where that motivation turns to action.
So, in some ways, it's an attempt to deal with the attempt to either humiliate or intimidate not just a single person, but an entire population.
Absolutely, I would agree. And many times when I've been involved in trials in the jury selection process, voir dire, one of the things I've talked about is that our criminal code, law in general, is nothing more than what we collectively have determined as inappropriate behavior. And so in terms of the adding this aggravator, which we've not talked about how this mm-hmm. will work, and sentencing, I believe that's the appropriate way that we make that statement, again, through our legislature and as a community, as this is particularly unacceptable behavior, and it is intended, as David said, not only to address that the specifics of that given crime, but as a message to the community at large.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here on No Limits. My guests are Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, who is the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here in Indiana. My guests are Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, who is the Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council in Indianapolis. Okay, so we've talked about this sort of broader subject of hate crimes and established the parameters of the problem and even some of the potential objections to the bill. Let's talk now about what the bill is, what it does. David, you want to go first?
Sure. So when we started talking about the legislation, we started talking about trying to create a new class of crime, basically a class of crimes titled hate crimes. We worked very closely with our national partners, the Anti-Defamation League, which hold the model legislation, worked on the federal legislation, have worked with a number of states around the country. It became pretty clear to us pretty quickly that creating a new class of crime was not necessarily going to fly here in Indiana for a number of objections. But we also talked with experts like Prosecutor Curry and the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council and legislators and zoned in on the idea of creating a sentence aggravator. So as Prosecutor Curry said, this language, if it should pass the General Assembly this year, would create basically the 12th aggravator that the prosecution can ask the judge to consider in sentencing, and the judge would then use this aggravator to determine whether there was a biased motivation to the crime during his sentencing.
So, Prosecutor Curry, talk me through how this, a practical circumstance in which how this might work in a court or in a case.
Certainly. And
break it down and speak slowly for me, because I'm not that smart. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right.
And David is correct. We had this conversation about focusing on how do you enhance the punishment as opposed to establishing a standalone crime. And so in any given crime, there is a range of sentence. So, for example, a level 4 felony, the range of a sentence is 2 to 12 years. And what's called the advisory sentence is 6 years. So the point of that is if you've been convicted of a level 4 felony, the presumption is your sentence would be 6 years, the advisory. Mm-hmm. If the court is to impose a sentence beyond the advisory, the court then will find that the aggravating factors exceed any mitigating factors. Vice versa, if it gives a sentence less than advisory, he finds the mitigating circumstances outweigh the aggravating factors. And there are now, with this bill, 12 explicit factors that the court could consider as aggravating factors, which gets back to my earlier response to your question. So as an aggravator for mm-hmm. purposes of sentencing, it could arise in the context of the trial in terms of proof. It could be separate proof presented to the judge at sentencing. And the court, I believe, could unilaterally conclude based upon what he or she has heard in the trial that bias was a motivation and then recite that as an aggravating factor for purposes of imposing the sentence.
I don't mean to to demean the concept here, but I'm going to say, to give a practical kind of situation. Let's suppose, David, I'm going to demean you here for a second,
no problem,
if that's okay. Let's suppose that David beats me up and makes reference to the fact that I am a balding white male while he's doing it. And he takes my wallet as part of that. And he's arrested for that. How do you go about establishing, even as an aggravator, that his motivation was that he doesn't like balding white guys rather than that he wanted my wallet?
Well, first of all, as a fellow balding white guy, I would find that particularly reprehensible.
I figured I'd have a sympathetic audience there.
But nevertheless, I guess I would go back to the practical situations that we have seen occur. David mentioned the incident in Bloomington. Mm-hmm. We have a pending case where we are absolutely certain it was motivated by the fact that the victim was gay, and so mm-hmm. so that is proven by statements and acts mm-hmm. that occurred. There was an incident a couple of years ago in Johnson County where two young men burned a cross mm-hmm. on the lawn of an African American family in Johnson County. At that time, the mm-hmm. Johnson County prosecutor actually bemoaned the fact that Indiana did not have a hate crime provision. And so it's just a matter of proving those, some of which are very explicit. If mm-hmm. someone painted a swastika mm-hmm. On the house of a person who was Jewish, or, and this is not what we talked about, that the suspect perceived the individual to be Jewish. That's pretty explicit in terms of that message. Other times it might be more subtle, but as a prosecutor, we would just have to address that on a case-by-case basis.
So the evidence, though, has to be fairly substantive there.
Like, sure.
I think we can all agree that you are trying to send a statement if you burn a swastika.
Yep.
Absolutely. The stuff that get... I'm trying to get into where the standard is, mm-hmm. whether it... David.
And actually, you touched on something, I think, a little bit unintentionally, but it sort mm-hmm. of goes back to the misconceptions about the bill and mm-hmm. some of the questions about why certain classes are protected. And I think your balding example is actually perfect, because we've gotten this question, what is it about these classes that warrant protection versus mm-hmm. if I just pick somebody out because they're short or they're overweight or they're bald or, something mm-hmm. along those lines. It falls back to the fact that there is a compelling interest. There's a government interest. Mm-hmm. There's a long history of discrimination against these particular classes that are warrant of addressing. And actually, the U.S. Supreme Court, when they ruled on hate crime statutes around the country, spoke specifically to this. There was a lot of questions about how you pick and choose those classes. And they spoke specifically to the fact that these classes that we are trying to protect – race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, things like that, there's a clear, compelling interest, government interest, that there's a long history of discrimination against these classes.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Jim has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. He asks, are there any actions that are deemed crimes only on the basis of this legislation?
No.
That is, that absent the hate crime designation would not be crimes.
No.
No?
No. And that's the point of making an aggravator is that there is an underlying crime mm-hmm. By which it has been committed because of the status of the victim.
And that actually gets to your earlier point, David, about why it wasn't created as a special class of crime, right?
Yeah, excellent. Right. Even if we had been able to create a special class of crime, it would have been special sort of in name. An underlying crime still would have had to have been committed, whether it's battery or assault or vandalism or something along those lines. But we really, that's why we really have come to like the aggravator concept, because we are working within the existing criminal code, within those existing crime statutes. And so, you know, those cases would be prosecuted just like they, you know, equally. And then, you know, at the point of sentencing or throughout the trial, you know, if there's a bias motivation that is clearly evident, you know, then it can be addressed.
And I think I would add there, too, as well, is you know, like in any other circumstance, you know, at that point and as an aggravator, it's up to the judge, you know, at that point. I mean, the judge will make the call based upon what he or she has heard as to whether that is present in this case, and if so, should it or should it not be a factor that weighs upon the sentence that the defendant receives?
You mentioned earlier that you're trying to fly a little bit under the radar screen, given the fact that, you know, in the Indiana General Assembly and, frankly, in Indiana state government altogether, we're having a huge conversation about, you know, what rights should be, what expression should be, whether there should be protected classes of any kind. In that environment right now, how is this? are you meeting some of those same arguments? And because I know you're involved in that debate too, David.
Mm-hmm. A little bit more on the outside this year. We were a little bit more involved in the Religious Freedom Act debate last year. But we are to a certain extent trying to fly under the radar a little bit. But, you know, clearly we could not walk into the General Assembly this session and not be intertwined in the conversations a little bit. You know, one thing I do want to stress is that the coalition that has come together around this particular issue, hate crimes, you know, which includes the Urban League, Concerned Clergy, Anti-Defamation League, obviously the prosecutor's office. You know, we began coming together to get ready for this conversation even before the religious freedom debate last year, even before the civil rights conversation this year. So, but you know, what we are hearing with legislators, and we are having a lot of really good conversations. You know, even though there's a lot of debate happening, there are a lot of questions around specific classes and things like that. But what we're hearing is that even if we are having that debate, even if there is some disagreement on you know, public accommodation and you know, housing and, you know, which classes should be in the Civil Rights Act or not, almost universally we're hearing, but we recognize that nobody should be targeted for a criminal act because of who they are fundamentally.
And are you hearing objections specifically to this bill? What are the natures of those? I mean, what arguments are you hearing? Because I think at some level it's similar to, if I'm going to be absolutely blunt here, the kind of discussion we are having about civil rights for LGBT. Mm-hmm. It is, no one wants to see anyone discriminated against, but...
Yeah, and we are absolutely running into some of that pushback. We're having those conversations as well, and we're just doing what we can to demonstrate that there is a compelling interest to, you know, to have these classes protected as well. I mean, clearly, when you look at the data, you know, sexual orientation was I made a mistake earlier when I said number three, but it was actually the number four. Mm-hmm. A targeted classification here in Indiana, but it is number three across the country. So, you know, so there clearly is a compelling interest to have these classes in the legislation. We're running into those conversations. We're trying to address them, and but you know, also a lot of it is coming back to those the conversation about the earlier sort of misperceptions about the bill. So I don't want to drive the message that it's only about that particular issue, those classes, but yeah, it's certainly something we're running up against.
We are talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ernest has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ernest, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I wrote an essay about 10 years ago on the need for hate crimes laws, which when I could get the reader to understand it, I tried to make it as concise as possible. Repeatedly, there have been over 100 people who told me that this is the first time they really understood the issue well enough to recognize the need for hate crimes legislation, and that it isn't special protection for anybody or any group of people. It is protection for, that mainly benefits the victims of the hate crimes. But it protects anybody that's subject to this sort of thing. But what I point out is, what I think is Mr. Curry, but I couldn't tell for sure who was speaking, spelled out to some degree, and that is there is a second crime on top of the initial crime, and the initial crime is used as an act of terrorism for everybody in the category that fits why he says he's attacking that particular person or group.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Go ahead, Ernest. And then I want to toss this to David and Terry and give them a chance to respond.
Okay. It's the first crime, whatever it is, should be, if it already is established that sort of thing, like the physical beating or something on that order, or vandalism to the person's property or the group's property, church or synagogue or mosque or something. The first crime, the vandalism is worth, or the attack is worth punishing according to the laws that are already on the book. The second crime is using the first crime as an act of terrorism, and that deserves its own punishment. We have a number of laws that are like that, where you can put on an extra penalty for using the initial crime for a secondary crime.
Okay, let me let David and Prosecutor Curry respond to that. Thanks very much for the call and for the insights.
Thank you, Ernest.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
David, we'll go first with you.
Great. Well, first of all, Ernest, thank you for your comments, and thank you for helping us to lay the groundwork for conversations about this legislation. We appreciate it. Ernest is absolutely correct, and this is one thing that we have been talking a lot about. In fact, Ernest said that this legislation offers special protection for anybody. I would actually say that it's not special. It's just...
Oh, actually, he said, to be fair to Ernest, he said the opposite.
Oh, okay,
that's the perception that people have. And he said that's not the case.
Right. So this is protection for everybody. Everybody has a race. Everybody has a color. Everybody has a national origin. Everybody has a sexual orientation. So this is legislation that covers everybody. A lot of times there is a misperception that, this legislation is only focused on minorities. But everybody is contained in the classes that we are seeking to protect against this legislation, so they are protected equally.
So at some level, to clarify here, at least the language then is neutral in that regard.
Absolutely.
It doesn't say, okay, it protects you if you're gay. It just says you cannot be attacked on the basis of your sexual orientation.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. Prosecutor Curry, you wanted to...
Yeah, and I would speak to Ernest's point about 10 years ago and, writing an essay at that time addressing it. I believe it's accurate to say that legislation addressing hate crime goes back as far as 1998. Mm-hmm. And I would like to take the opportunity to thank Senator Glick for sponsoring the bill this time, as well as Senator Taylor, Senator Rogers, and Representative Greg Porter for their participation in the past. But it ultimately gets to the point that David made and I made as well, which is I think it made it easier for us to address this issue with the legislature by not having it as a standalone crime, as having it built in as a punishment for the motive for the crime. And additionally, Ernest is absolutely right, and this is part of the message, is that when an individual commits this sort of crime, they are trying to terrorize an entire neighborhood.
We are talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here on No Limits. My guests are Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, Director of Government Affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council in Indianapolis. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation here on No Limits. My guests are Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar, who is the director of government affairs for the Jewish Community Relations Council in Indianapolis. If you'd like to join the conversation, please send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what Chris has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
This might be a question for David, but Indianapolis's civic literacy champion, Sheila Kennedy, has stated that legislating hate crime could be problematic because you're essentially criminalizing thought, and it could go against First Amendment constitutional rights. I mean, I'm for you know, protecting certain classes, or in this case, you know, anyone. So I was just wondering if David or maybe Curry, Prosecutor Curry, could comment on you know, resolving that kind of issue.
That is a question we alluded to earlier, but you've given a more concise presentation of it. Thanks very much for the call, Chris.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
David.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I appreciate that. And actually, I know Sheila very well. She's an esteemed professor of mine when I went through the school at SPIA at IU. And we have had a number of conversations about this. So I appreciate that. Really, you know, this again comes down to sort of one of the misperceptions. And I wouldn't dare hold myself in the same regard as Sheila. I mean, clearly a just a civil rights expert and champion. You know, but when we look at the legislation, again, I go back to the fact that we really are criminalizing the action and not the thought. You know, you are free to believe and think whatever you want. But when you turn that belief into motive and action, and it becomes the basis for the bias motivation of the crime, you know, then it becomes something that we have to address. And the Supreme Court in a case, Wisconsin v. Mitchell, which was ruled on in 1993, addressed a lot of these issues and ruled unanimously that not only were hate crime statutes constitutional, but that there was no cooling effect on free speech.
Prosecutor Curry.
Yeah, and clearly, again, the underlying act is what constitutes the crime. Mm-hmm. And that could be any number of crimes. The most obvious examples that would occur are battery, a homicide, arson, those sort of things. And so we don't get to the aggravator unless we prove a criminal act, a crime as defined by our criminal code.
Right. And what we're talking here about is, again, I'm not an attorney like Prosecutor Curry, but, you know, again, what we're talking about is motivation. And when you look at something like murder, the physical act of killing another person, you know, there are multiple ways that act can be prosecuted, and all of them are based on motive and intent, which is exactly what we're trying to address here.
Which
in this
gets tricky. I mean, that was one of the things, though, and the thing that kicked this off, the Matthew Shepard case that we alluded to. In that case, the people responsible for that crime already were facing the death penalty, so it was difficult to enhance the penalties. The other argument that you often hear about this is that this is a largely symbolic response to, you know, to these problems. I'll let either one of you take it. And I know what the argument is on the other side.
Sure. You know, I would say that, yes, in something like a murder, you know, the Matthew mm-hmm. Shepard case, the just what happened mm-hmm. last year, the Charleston shooting, yeah. you know, right. The, you know, certainly that those types of cases cannot be enhanced. Mm-hmm. You know, but we do think that there are certain cases where, you know, that are batteries or things like that, crimes that aren't quite as heinous as murder, where there is value in enhancing the penalty. But yeah, there is something that is associated with bias crimes, and that is, you know, the community impact and the fact that these crimes need to be addressed sort of on a community level. And so when these things happen, we see communities calling for hate crimes charges, and there is something to be said for allowing that charge to take place. I mean, in the Charleston shooting, obviously he'll be charged with a capital crime, may face the death penalty, but you know, he is looking at 33 federal hate crimes charges. And yeah, to a certain extent, there is something symbolic about that. But really also there is some value in enhancing penalties for those lower crimes.
We, and as usual, when we talk about things like this, we're getting a lot of calls here at the end. So I'm going to ask both our callers and our panelists to be tight in making their points so we can give as many people a chance as possible. Norman, welcome to the program.
Hello,
Norman. What's on your mind?
Oh, good afternoon. How are you, John?
Doing well.
Good afternoon to your distinguished guest.
Hi, Norman.
I have a question.
Sure.
Will this, with a law like this, we've seen in many situations. Maybe you might not, guys might not deem it, but for us, it's been around for a while. You know, you as well. We've seen to where sometimes, depending on a person's or a public official's position, or where they sit at in their particular stature, they sometimes can slip between the cracks. So what my question is, will the arms on this be reaching forward enough or far enough to even grab someone in that position? And also, where would that tie in to, like, bullying and as a hate crime? Because, you know, sometimes there are bullies that, you know, do the same thing to intimidate one, and so how would that fit in? You know, I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks very much for the call, Norman. Well, should we start with Prosecutor Curry on this one?
Yeah, I'm not sure I understood the first part of Norman's question. It's I took it that he was referring to, you know, if public officials commit
that
a crime, certainly the aggravating factor, if present, would apply no matter who committed the crime. And it's the latter part in terms of bullying. The possible crimes that fall under that would arise from a bullying situation could be battery if there was actually a physical attack. It could be intimidation, which is a crime. And going forward, if this becomes the law, and it's apparent from the investigation and information developed in the investigation, certainly as the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, we will utilize this aggravator as part of our prosecution.
We are talking about hate crimes and hate crime legislation. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Vernell, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Yes, my concerning question is, what is actually pushing the legislation for hate crime at this point? I'm familiar with legislation being presented year after year after year, and I was told it's not going to move forward. It's not something that the Indiana legislators want to make happen. Given the climate of the country now, it's okay to kill black. And the history of Indiana, I'm curious as to why Indiana is one of five states that has not drafted and put forth any hate crime legislation. So my question is, what is pushing this legislation now?
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. I think it's a great one. You know, I really do think it's just kind of a confluence of events. Unfortunately, some of those tragic. I think we've seen a lot of bias-motivated crimes take place, some really heinous things over the last couple of years. There was a shooting at the hands of a neo-Nazi at a Jewish community center in Kansas City. There was the Charleston shooting that took place last year. There was the shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. I think some of those really sort of tragic events have raised the consciousness of not only folks in Indiana, but across the country as to the necessity for this type of legislation. And I think, you know, we have had some great leadership at the General Assembly who, you know, Representative Porter and some others who have introduced this legislation year after year. And I think that really this year, some community support has come together to help them push the issue up the hill. You know, like I said, we have all come together equally. You know, the Indianapolis Urban League, the Concerned Clergy, Fair Housing Center, the Jewish community, the Prosecutor Curry, and some national organizations like the Anti-Defamation League. And I think everybody has just sort of said, now it's time. It's time that we do this, and let's push this thing up over the hill.
Has it helped?
To answer what I believe to be the first part of it, it's a logistical question of how it gets out of the legislature. And David can correct me if I'm wrong. I don't believe that these bills in the past have ever even had a committee hearing, which means that they were dead on arrival. In this instance, we not only got a committee hearing this past week, but it passed out of committee 9-0.
It did come out of a House committee in 2007, I believe, but died on the House floor. I don't know that it's ever been discussed in the Senate. So, you know, as Prosecutor Curry said, we really did take a big step forward this week, and we're rather excited about it.
And I know you said you're trying to keep your distance from that other law. But at some level, could it possibly have helped that we are having a huge statewide conversation right now about what constitutes rights, what constitutes bias?
Absolutely. I do think it has helped us raise some awareness around this issue. It has helped us get in the door and talk with some folks that have not addressed these issues before, and now they are on their radar, and it's given us an opportunity to add this element onto the discussion. Absolutely.
Got an email question from a listener named Rance. If you'd like to reach out to us via email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. Rance says, doesn't this amount to punishing people for thought? Why not just make the punishment for the actual crime harsher and forget the aggregator? Is there a published list and ranking system that people can look at to see which class is highest on the scale?
Well, if the first part of the question is the point of the aggravator is to make the sentence more severe. And actually going back to earlier discussion about whether the underlying crime was a murder or a battery or whatever, every single crime, including murder, has a range of sentence. And so other than a homicide where there's a request for death penalty or life without parole, there is a range of sentence. For murder, it's 45 to 65 years is the range of sentence.
So within the accepted range, what you're saying
is,
to use the example you spoke of earlier, there's a range within a certain class of felony from 2 years to 12 years.
Correct.
And what you're saying is that since that could be to move it from the two-year end up toward the 12-year end.
Correct. And so, for example, it would certainly be within the court's discretion if it determined that the crime had been motivated by the race of the victim to impose that 12-year sentence as opposed to the 6-year advisory sentence. And so there is the punishment aspect, and that's precisely what we feel is appropriate.
And just real quick, once again, I just do want to stress that, you know, this is not punishing thought. And you know, again, the Supreme Court would bear me out on this, that you are free to think whatever you want. It is when you take that thought process, you turn it into motivation, into a bias, and then act on it.
Well, it motivates you to act, as
exactly.
It were, and gets to it. You talked about the fact that it's gone further than it has, at least since 2007. It's moved out of committee now. walk people through where it where the process goes from here.
Sure. So right, it did come out of the Senate Corrections and Criminal Code Committee earlier this week, 9-0 unanimously. It should be on eligible for amendments on Monday, and then on final passage in the Senate on Tuesday. So by Tuesday or Wednesday, we could know whether this legislation will be passed by the Senate. It will move over to the House of Representatives, and then we start the process all over again.
And have you done a head count on that, knowing as a recovering lobbyist myself, I'm assuming that you have.
We're in that process right now. I don't have numbers. Right
and
now.
What are your prospects? Do you think it's likely you're going to make it out?
I think that the with it coming out of the committee 9-0, that gives it a lot of momentum, and I do feel pretty good about it coming out of the Senate.
You need 26 votes, right? So you've got to assume that you've got a third of those already. Then, if they all voted for it in committee, what are the prospects of the House? In the House,
we have a long road. There were a couple of House bills introduced in the first half of the session, and neither one of those received a hearing. And so we will continue to have to make the case with those folks that, it's something that they need to address, that they need to take a look at, start the discussion. We have a long road ahead of us, but, obviously we're in it to win it. And, we'll continue making our case, educating folks. And I think if it comes out of the Senate with a good margin, that will give it a lot of momentum to get the discussion rolling in the House.
And then the last step of that process is the governor has to sign it. Have you had any conversations with Governor Pence about whether he would in fact sign this?
We've not had that conversation yet. I think I think we're going to cross that bridge when we get there.
Gotten a last second question via Facebook from Allison says, how do we help the public understand the difference between acts that reflect hate for one's belief versus the civil expectation to be served regardless of religion? David, I'll throw that one to you.
Well, I think, something that we continually stress, that we've talked about today is that, these are crimes. We are talking about crimes. A crime has to be committed. So obviously we're having a discussion about accommodation and, how folks should be treated. But clearly, we can make the argument that nobody should be targeted for criminal behavior because of who they are. We continue to stress that the underlying crime has to take place, and we need to recognize that.
In about 30 seconds, Prosecutor Curry, how will this change the way you do your job if it becomes law?
It will just give us an additional tool in terms of addressing, and I think it goes back to the term message, which we talked about several times. And generally, I'm not big on the idea that we prosecute someone to send a message. But to the extent that the criminal act was intended to send a message to the Jewish community, the African-American community, in terms of the motivation, correspondingly, we would like to send a message that we will not accept that behavior.
I'd like to thank you both. I'd like to thank my guests, Marion County Prosecutor Terry Curry and David Sklar of the Jewish Community Relations Council. It's been a very lively conversation. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.